Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Even the most basic analysis of this morning's unemployment report gives you a pretty good insight. Since the recession started a year ago, this economy has lost 7,500 jobs every single day. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. You made it to another Friday, gang. This one is the 5th of December. Good to have you with us. I try not to do this too often, but I'm going to have to throw a whole slew of numbers at you here right as we get going. Context is important when you're dealing with unemployment and recessions. The economy lost 533,000 jobs last month. That's the most since 1974. And the unemployment rate of 6.7% is the highest since 1993. Needless to say, the report was worse than anybody thought, and they were thinking some pretty bad things. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson gets us started.
The employment number is widely viewed as the most important economic indicator released on a regular basis. It affects so many other things: growth, personal income, and industrial production. November's job losses almost guarantee that the nation will have shed 2 million jobs this year.
We're in a prolonged recession. Began officially over a year ago, but I think we're in the depths of the recession now.
That's John Silvio, Wachovia's chief economist. He says some of the job cuts are coming from companies looking ahead to a bleak 2009.
I think there are some preemptive cuts in terms of firms trying to cut employment prior to the end of the year so they can start the new year with a tighter ship.
He says the cuts are coming from all sectors of the economy. Andrew Sum directs the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University.
There are very few sectors left that are adding anything or holding their own.
He says the possibility of a multiplying effect is becoming a reality. All those jobless Americans will spend less, leading to more layoffs and on and on. He says even people who haven't lost their jobs are fueling the fire.
We'll continue to be more pessimistic about the outlook and continue to cut back spending, which will only make this situation get worse, until somebody feels that there's a turnaround coming soon.
And do you feel that that's coming anytime soon?
No.
Some says expect payroll declines for at least the next 3 months. And keep in mind, this week's cuts at AT&T, DuPont, and Viacom, more than 19,000 jobs in all, aren't even counted in today's report. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Those numbers Jeremy ended with are a good starting point for this next story. It is not a good thing that a year into a recession, job losses are getting steeper, because any eventual recovery hinges in large part on people getting or keeping jobs and starting to buy again. So given that, we asked our senior business correspondent Bob Moon to figure out, now what?
The idea that those who don't learn from the past are condemned to repeat it is difficult to apply this time around.
There's never been an economic cycle like this one, so examples from history are pretty sketchy.
Ian Shepherdson is chief U.S. economist at High Frequency Economics. He says there are some similarities to the Great Depression, so what might work is a massive stimulus plan like FDR's New Deal, perhaps as President-elect Obama is considering focusing on public works projects to rebuild the nation's infrastructure.
Public spending would provide substantial employment in some of the very weakest bits of the economy, like construction, and it would make room for the private sector to continue its adjustment without the economy having to be in total freefall, as it appears to be at the moment.
The advantage of infrastructure is that, unlike consumer spending, you can't import bridges from China.
S&P's chief economist David Weiss agrees the government may need to take over in a big way. But
you got to be careful, because Japan tried the same thing when they ran into this in the 90s, and they put in huge infrastructure projects. They basically paved every square inch of the island, and you still didn't really get out of the slowdown. It did keep the unemployment rate under control, though.
Once burned, the Japanese were shy to spend, borrow, and invest. Instead, they socked their money away. Sound familiar? University of Maryland economist Peter Morici says the government needs to do more than just flood the market with money.
Two things will get people back to work: get the banks lending again by putting conditions on the loans that we make to the banks, and fixing the trade deficit. We simply consume much more than we produce. In the end, there's not enough work for Americans because we're not buying the products here. So we have to fix the trade deficit.
That solution could take a variety of directions, including reforms that might be aimed at encouraging new business growth, which ultimately is a necessary part of any long-term fix. Whatever the solution ends up being, economist Ian Shepherdson says it'll take time.
The problem is that, of course, none of these things work very quickly. And it means that we're probably going to see a run of pretty terrible payroll numbers stretching out for quite a few months yet.
In other words, we're learning as we go, the hard way. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
This almost seems like crazy talk given where oil and gas prices were this past summer. But I actually heard a pundit today talking about dollar a gallon gas. It's been almost a decade since pump prices have been that low. And with oil touching $40 a barrel today, it doesn't seem out of reach. In a lot of ways, it'd be a welcome turn of events. For months, we've been telling you about businesses suffering from the high price of oil. Airlines, car makers, truckers, you name it. How are they doing now that crude's down 70%? Marketplace's Elisa Roth has that story.
This is one of those stories where the answer should be really obvious. Cheap crude should be good for everybody, right? Well, except maybe for companies like Exxon or Shell who are actually selling this stuff. But even then, it's not that simple. Take refineries. Those are the companies that buy the crude and then turn it into stuff like gas or diesel. Bill Day works at Valero, a big independent refinery.
As the price of oil comes down, that means that we're paying less for every barrel of oil that we buy.
So far, so good. Except that Valero's profits depend on the so-called gasoline margin. That's the difference between Valero's cost for raw materials, crude, and how much it can charge for the finished product, gas.
That margin is actually negative now. The price of oil has fallen a great deal, but the price of gasoline has fallen even farther.
Day says it's not all bad news. They're not losing money on diesel or jet fuel. But that might be why airline execs aren't jumping up and down. Michael Boyd runs an airline consulting business. He says $150 a barrel oil was truly unsustainable for airlines. But that doesn't mean the fuel-guzzling planes are flying high at today's prices either.
That's still a challenge because no airplane flying today, no airliner, was designed for $50 a barrel oil. They didn't even consider it.
Anyway, he says, the airlines are still recovering from the massive losses the expense of fuel did to them. As for Bill Day, he doesn't want to sound like an ingrate. After all, refiners didn't love $150 oil. But he says a little stability right now could really help. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Just so you don't think we forgot, car makers were back on Capitol Hill today. Again, not a whole lot of love for a bailout. The word bankruptcy was mentioned more than a couple of times. And as they did yesterday, the big three CEOs said they'd agree to just about anything in return for the money. On Wall Street today, well, I don't know. Somehow traders saw fit to bump the major indices up, and quite a bit, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Jobs numbers we talked about up top are probably going to be the most remembered headline of the week. But there has been a whole lot of other stuff going on. The recession that we are officially now in. Another whipsaw week in the markets. And, of course, automakers on Capitol Hill. We've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon from Portfolio.com with us for our weekly wrap. Nice to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Felix, almost in spite of myself, we have to start with cars this week, and I'm just going to put it right to you. You think this bailout's going to happen or not?
Yes, I think it's going to happen. I don't think the government has any choice. They can't face a massive liquidation of the entire auto industry with unemployment doing what it's doing. What it's going to look like, I have no idea, but everyone's running around in circles and is panicking, so that doesn't make for good strategic decisions normally.
Well, Lee, let me ask you the logical follow-on question then, which is, what about this prepackaged bankruptcy they've been talking about for General Motors, which it says is going to run out of money by Christmas?
Well, you know, that's an interesting concept, and a lot of people are saying what some of the details in the proposals are actually little more than an out-of-court bankruptcy anyway. But, you know, that basically puts a nicer spin on it. And as we know, spin has been a lot of the problem here. There's no question that for GM in particular, the situation has gotten a lot more dire, literally by the day. I mean, we saw new vehicle sales come out earlier this week, and they just plummeted, and they were worse for everyone across the board.
GM has been blaming the idea that people think it might go into bankruptcy for the fact that its vehicle sales fell, but clearly that can't be the case.
Well, you don't buy the theory then that people just won't buy buy cars from a bankrupt car maker?
Not if the government's standing behind the warranties. A bankruptcy is just a change of ownership. Nothing else really changes.
I agree. I think you're seeing a lot of posturing there.
I want to ask you guys a question that's been bugging me for a week or two now. Why is it that car makers are getting such a thorough going over for what is, in the grand scheme of bailouts, a relatively small amount of money, whereas the financial sector, granted, the $700 billion got voted down once in Congress, but since then, it's been Katie bar the door giving them money without much of a second thought. Felix, what do you think?
I think that people are regretting the blank check they gave to Hank Paulson for the financial industry. They realized that he hadn't got a clue what he wanted to do with it. He kept on changing his mind. He doesn't quite know who he wants to bail out or how or why. And they don't want to make the same mistake twice. They don't want to see this money wasted.
I would also say that there's really a recognition that the car companies have brought so much of this on themselves. I mean, if you look at the value destruction that's happened in Detroit over the past few decades, it's really unbelievable. And what's interesting here is there hasn't been much talk of management changes. And I think the American public has a right to be skeptical. These companies have gotten bailouts before and have ended up basically in the same situation.
Well, Lee, let me ask you this. Why does Rick Wagoner, the CEO of General Motors, still have his job?
That's a very good question. I don't have an answer for that. I also don't know why he got in a car and drove to Washington. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, Saturday Night Live did a skit where the three CEOs got in their car and drove, and then they got in their car and drove.
With life it's imitating art, right?
Exactly.
And now they're driving back. Bless them.
That's right. And I'm sure it's a much somber drive, too. There is talk that Henry Paulson, speaking of bailouts and figureheads, Henry Paulson is going to go back to Congress and ask for the second half of his bailout package, the TARP, $350 billion. Lee, what do you think those hearings are going to look like when he goes to Congress and says, I need some more money?
I think they're going to be tough. I think that we have some bailout fatigue here, and I think that, you know, when you think back, it seems like so long ago, but back in mid-September, late September, when the first bailout plan was greeted with hosannas and hailed as going to really get us out of this mess. Between then and now, it's been switched a few times, and I think there's a lot of skepticism about whether we should be doing this.
Felix, is he going to get the money?
I don't know, frankly. It's a lame duck Congress, and people want a strategic long-term plan, and Hank Paulson is not going to give them that because he's going to be out of a job come January 20. So why would you sign a $350 billion blank check without any indication of how it's going to be spent? I think it's going to be hard.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, Felix Salmon at Portfolio. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Cheers, Kai.
There was a pretty famous investing book a number of years ago called A Random Walk Down Wall Street. Today, and occasionally over the next couple of months, Marketplace is going to be taking a slightly more structured approach to that stretch of pavement. We're going to meet some of the men and women at the banks, brokerages, and investment houses that are at the center of the fallout from the financial crisis, and so get a sense of the culture of Wall Street. Hedge funds have been blamed for a lot of what's happened in the past year or so. Despite their losses, they haven't gotten a lot of sympathy because they're pretty opaque and they're off limits to most of us. Marketplace's Amy Scott paid a visit to one fund that's hoping to take the lemons that this economy is offering and make lemonade.
It's just after noon on a recent day at Page Capital Management. Chris Page is making one of the day's most important decisions.
Are you hungry?
Where to order lunch.
Oh, yeah, we eat all our meals here because we're here all the time, so. That's one perk of the job. I'll give it that.
In the hedge fund world, Page Capital is a baby, just 1 year old. And it's not quite the shark tank you might imagine. It's more of a family affair. Sisters Michelle and Jessica Page founded the firm. Chris, the general counsel, is married to Michelle. They manage less than $100 million, mostly invested by rich families. On this day, the founders are celebrating. A major pension fund has expressed interest in investing. While most funds have been bleeding money, Jessica Page says Page Capital is up for the year.
We're really excited about that. I mean, if you can do well in this market, I mean, it's the true test, isn't it?
They've pulled that off partly by using a classic hedge fund strategy. that is, by betting that stock prices will go down. It's called short selling. There are other ways to make money in a down market. Michelle Page says her firm is poised to invest in the bonds and bank loans of companies that are bankrupt or getting close. It's known as distressed debt.
We think this is the golden age of distressed debt investing coming up.
Page expects a wave of bankruptcies in the coming months. She plans to buy some of that distressed debt, help fix up the companies, and then sell the debt at a profit. Page knows how it sounds to make money from other people's misery. Distressed investors are also known as vultures.
To a certain extent, there's a ghoulish factor to it. I mean, you're basically the undertaker of the financial world. You know, we'll do some liquidations where we just, you know, take them under. But by and large, our job, and what we try to do, is go into the situations where the patient is, you know, dying, but we can turn it around and fix them up and make them a healthy patient.
Lunch arrives and everyone gathers in the conference room. While her team eats pork chops and salad, Michelle Page conducts business on the speakerphone.
So if I had a friend and another fund who also wanted to buy some, they would be able to have enough supply for both of us?
Chief Operating Officer Mark Chenault downs some pasta before heading back to work. He knows Michelle from Harvard Business School. Chenault left a job at a major Wall Street firm in the spring to join her hedge fund. His timing turned out to be impeccable.
It's funny, looking back, I've always believed that I didn't have the risk appetite to work at a small shop like this. It turns out, since I've been here, I've been so much happier. There's no safety anymore, I think, in being at a big financial institution.
These days, hedge funds don't look much safer. Burned investors are pulling money out. The funds can no longer rely on easy debt to juice their returns. Page plans to steer clear of leverage. The rich hedge fund compensation scheme is also under attack. Managers tend to earn 2% of the total assets, plus another 20% of any profits. Page Capital charges a bit less. Even in this environment, Michelle Page says investors who aren't afraid to work at it can make money.
You know, I think a lot of people went into finance because A, it was sexy, and B, it was easy. And now it's not going to be sexy anymore. It's going to probably be more regulated, and it certainly isn't going to be easy.
Page Capital's prospects look good on paper. There are 9 Ivy League degrees in this group of 6, about 25 years collective experience in finance. They'll need the stomach to ride out the recent market volatility. When stocks rallied on the Citigroup bailout last week, Page's bets against the market cost them about $250,000. They've made most of it back since then. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, job cuts and recession morale.
Well, during times like this, what people struggle with most is the anxiety of it, the uncertainty of it. They don't know when the next shoe is going to drop.
But first, let's do the numbers. Our take on the market's big jump today is pretty easy. You figure it out, because we can't. In spite of that horrible jobs report, the Dow Industrials jumped 259 points, 3%, closed the week at 8,635. The NASDAQ added 63 points, almost 4.5%, finished at 1509. The S&P 500 advanced 30 points, 3.2%, wrapped up trading at 876. The weekly tally tells a different story. For the week, the Dow dropped 2.2%. The NASDAQ stumbled 1.7%. The S&P 500 fell 2.3%. Bond prices edged lower for a change. Go figure that one out. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.7%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at splendidtable.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Senate Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee looks at food assistance and child nutrition programs in the economic downturn. Also in Washington, the Pew Center on the States holds their Voting in America Summit. They'll discuss innovations and reforms in the election process. And on December 8, 1941, the U.S. declared war against Japan following the attack on Pearl Harbor. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Just when you thought you were done with campaign finance stories for another 4 years, Vice President-elect Joe Biden's gone and ruined your day. Not just him, really. His boss and Hillary Clinton, too. Backing up an Obama campaign promise, today Biden sent out an email blast asking supporters to help retire Senator Clinton's campaign debts. She still owes more than $7 million to the businesses that worked for her. It's kind of a problem because assuming she's confirmed as Secretary of State, there are laws that say she can't go out and raise that money herself. To help figure out what options the senator has, we've called Jean Cummings again. She writes for Politico. Jean, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Jean, I can think of two possible sources of money that Hillary Clinton has right now. One is her Senate reelection campaign account. First of all, why can't she use part of that?
Well, she had already transferred her balance into her presidential campaign.
Okay.
And so much of that money already was absorbed.
The other source of money I can think of that she might have some access to is from the guy who won the race, who we learned last night has raised $750 million through the course of the campaign. He, though, can't really use that money, right?
He ended the campaign with $30 million in the bank. But the trouble is, if he were to give money to her, he would have to do it under the limits of donations because it would count as a political donation. So he could only give her $2,300.
So that's really not going to help very much, is it?
No, that won't. However, if he headlined an event for her and a lot of people showed up with that kind of money, she could raise some money pretty quickly.
What's your take on the Clintons as fundraisers? Are they effective at going out there and asking people for their money?
They're very effective at it. And that's why I think if she's determined to wipe this off, the two of them, she and her husband, could do so relatively quickly. They're big personalities. They have a great sense of loyalty with the party activists, the party base. They know all the big fundraisers in the party. They know all the really wealthy people in the party. And so they can tap into all of those networks and probably raise, you know, several million dollars in really short order.
What happens if she doesn't get this done for some reason?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think if she stiffs some of these vendors, that's a kind of reputation that sticks with a candidate and not a good thing to leave people hanging out there, you know, especially small businesses and that sort of thing. Even during the campaign, we had, when we did an early story about how she was postponing a lot of these payments, what we discovered is that certain vendors in Iowa and New Hampshire were calling ahead to people they knew in South Carolina and later states and warning them to get their cash up front. So this business community can talk to each other, and you don't want to leave a lot of hard feelings behind.
Jean Cummings covers money and politics for Politico. Jean, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Everybody's feeling the squeeze of a stuck economy. At home, sure. And even when you go to work, you can't really get away from it. Here at Marketplace, it's potluck at the boss's house for the holiday party. Still, though, we're lucky because with layoffs and cutbacks, some places are downright bleak. They sure are where Liz Brown, Angel Gonzalez, and Peter Liebman work.
People aren't doing as much for Christmas. Like, we're not doing Secret Santa and stuff like that.
Pay cuts. People got laid off. Everybody's mad about their bonuses.
There's absolutely no holiday party. Hours are going to be cut back. It's doom and gloom, definitely.
Profit forecasts aren't great. Neither are your odds for a year-end bonus. That's never good for morale or the bottom line. Author Marcus Buckingham wrote a book called The Truth About You, Your Secret to Success. And he says when employees think their jobs are in jeopardy, productivity just takes a nosedive.
Well, during times like this, what people struggle with most is the anxiety of it, the uncertainty of it. They don't know when the next shoe is going to drop.
Spence Mahan's waiting for that shoe. He's grabbing lunch outside the financial services firm he works for here in downtown Los Angeles.
Everyone kind of speculates because they have a lot of meetings recently, and it's one of those where they keep telling us, oh, your jobs are fine, but every time they have a meeting, tell us our jobs are fine, they make us nervous.
Marcus says managers ought to bear in mind that the death by a thousand cuts approach just isn't going to do it.
So if you're a manager going, I'm going to just do it little bit by bit by bit and hope the employees don't notice, well, unfortunately, they're smarter than that. They're going to pick it up. Any decision you make to cut costs, much better that you come right out and say that's exactly what you're doing.
All right, so number two.
At an after-work wine tasting, music industry executive Jean-Christophe Chamborodon is trying to deal with that stress.
I'm here drinking wine right now, so that could be the answer.
He did his first layoffs not too long ago.
I felt I was a total monster.
And ever since, he's been trying to reassure his clients, his employees, everybody, without much luck.
It's kind of a Pavlov complex. When things get bad, people lose their coolness and don't understand that you have to work together to make it through.
Marcus Buckingham points out there are some ways to boost morale in bad economic times, selectively.
Go sit down with the people that you know you're going to need as you move forward and talk to them about why they are going to be so valuable for the future and why that together you're going to have to work really hard in order to build that future.
Kathy Didion sipping wine down the bar. Her boss in Detroit took that positive approach, she says. It kind of worked.
So I'm positively thinking that in 2.5 years I'm really going to be able to retire.
Laughing so she doesn't cry, I guess, in an economy that's lost 2.5 million jobs in the past 12 months.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, it's not just Hillary Clinton whose debts are piling up. The entire state of California has come up a little short of cash. The state finance director said today he's going to have to start issuing IOUs instead of checks if lawmakers can't close an $11 billion budget gap. He didn't actually use the word IOU, of course. Businesses that have state contracts, everybody from gardeners to food service companies, will get what are called warrants, promises to pay up with interest, which I guess sounds better than saying, I don't know, the check's in the mail. That is Marketplace on this Friday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 259 points, 3%. The Nasdaq gained 63 points, 4.4%. The S&P 500 added 30 points, 3.6%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, what happens when you keep a close eye on charities?
Since 9/11, American Muslim charitable organizations have found it increasingly confusing and difficult. The government has essentially put our charitable organizations under the microscope.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.